But at the end of Fox's life, people look back at him, as William Penn says, and William Penn knew what he was talking about, as the chief instrument in renewing the Christian religion, which is what he meant by Quakerism, at this period of history, after the long night of apostasy, the way he puts it. If you ask who was God's chief instrument, person that God had chosen to be the initiator of this revival of primitive Christianity, you would, if you had to choose one man, you would choose Fox. So I don't think I need to argue that point any further. Fox realized the importance of having fellow workers. He says in one of the early pages, which I think you may be reading, "As we traveled through the country preaching repentance to people, the Lord said unto me, if I did but set up one in the same spirit that the prophets and apostles were in that gave forth the scriptures, he or she should shake all the country in their profession." 10 miles about that. I'm not sure that that is a reference to traveling preachers. I think what he means is, if I could go through England and put one key person in each place, there'd be a little circle around them, and that'd be one way of sort of sowing. I don't think he's speaking of these ministers, but it shows that his sense of the what one person can do locally, and certainly what one person can do traveling about, would follow. And for the present, to confirm what I've already said, we think of this loose, unorganized group of fellow missionaries without any very definite organization. Now, there's no exact list of these people, there are hints of one. And in this book by Taylor, there's a second edition, I didn't put the date down. He gives about 66. George Fox says in another passage that he had appointed 70 people to go out from the north and travel. The editors took pains to change that 70 to about 60. Do you know why?
Some of them later turned Quaker heretics?
No, I don't think so. Christ once sent out 70 people in the Gospel of Luke. You read that. He had 12 disciples, but he also had a group of 70. And the likeness was a little bit too nearly blasphemous to suit the editors. So they changed the original statement. Perhaps they knew that the figures were more nearly 60. This man counts 66. Men and women. Not so many women as the men, but several women in the list. He has the list here, and if you ever look up this book, you'll see what a slender little volume it is. Here's a little list here on two pages under the headings. It begins Thomas Airy, yeoman, that is a husbandman, a farmer, and the place of residence. And it goes down and includes, I say, about 66. Now you can make a study then of this band of Quaker missionaries. These call them another name, the First Publishers of Truth. And learn something about them, and you can even learn something about their occupations. Always a sociologist likes to know what class of society the movement came from. And that's been studied with regard to other groups. And I have a special reason this morning for reading this classification. Two gentlemen. You have, these are ancient words, you have some idea what that meant in the 17th century. 13 yeomen. Yeomen were people attached to the soil, farmers, tenant farmers, or copyhold, freehold farmers. Now, husbandmen would be another group in the farming area, in the soil, where these people worked on the soil. I wouldn't say necessarily farmers, they could include shepherds and so on, but people attached in one way or other to the soil. One wage earner. That seems a little small, but you remember how little industry played, a little part of industry played. One miller, 8 craftsmen and shopkeepers, 4 schoolmasters, 2 soldiers, although of course the soldier was not a professional soldier, but he must have had some other profession. I don't think he'd be a professional soldier. Other professions, 2, and not ascertained, 4, that's the list. You see then that a very large proportion of them were attached to the soil. And that's not the lower class, that's the middle class, or upper middle class.
How many husbandmen were?
Husbandmen are 17 and yeomen 13. That's a distinction that wouldn't make too much difference to us. But a husbandman certainly is attached to the soil. That is 34 altogether that were closely attached to the soil, apparently. Now the 12 women in the list, a smaller number, 54 men and 12 women, 4 were the wives of yeomen, and 1 was a sister of a yeoman, 1 was the wife of a shopkeeper, and 1 a sister of a craftsman. I expect where the man is mentioned, it means they lived with a brother, if they're given a sister. One of them, we know that she belonged to a considerable family in the world. The world is the non-Quaker category, of course. She belonged to a considerable family in the world. 2 of them were maids at a farm near Swarthmore. And Mary Fisher, another one whose name we'll meet, was in service, that means a maid, in another place. Well, they seemed like plain countrymen. When they came down to London, that's what people down there thought of when they arrived down there, plain countrymen. Some of them, before they were converted, thought even less of them than that, but they became acquainted with it. I say that you have to guess, get at these names from various ways. William Penn, in the preface he wrote to Fox's Journal in 1691, named 21 of these people who had, and they're in this list, who had come from the north and had already died in 1691. There were others who were still living, and of course there would be others. But one way or another you can get at the names of the chief of these itinerant preachers. And they nearly all came from northwest England, in here, western Yorkshire, northern Lancashire, Westmoreland, perhaps from Cumberland. And by 1654, they had begun to travel, with some exceptions. I already said that Margaret Fell, who's in the list, was tied at home and didn't travel. She did a very good service for the movement. Without doing much traveling. But they began traveling. Now, our knowledge of their early experience is, of course, those other than the left journals, though not as elaborate as Fox, those people we know something about from their journals, or from what has been written up in modern biographies. We know, however, mainly about their work from 2 sources, one of which I've mentioned before, and that is the Swarthmore manuscripts, the letters written in to Margaret Fell by these various people from where they were. And that is the first source of knowledge. The second is another collection. I put the name of it on the board, this collection here, and this is the book in which the book that was published, you see, it's a pretty good-sized book. These are records, which I'll explain in a moment. But let me, first of all, just by sample, read from some of the letters that these people wrote in, mostly to Margaret Fell, or if they wrote somebody else, that person would very likely forward the letter to Margaret Fell, you see, so that we have these letters. One of them named Edward Barrow, you see his name on the list, writing from London in 1658. All things here are very well, and our means of late very quiet and precious. Those are not the same meaning. Quiet means undisturbed by either the mob or the police, and precious means a deep and satisfactory spiritual occasions. And always large. And now at Westminster we have a great place as big as the Bull and Mouth near the Abbot. They'd already hired a building called the Bull and Mouth. You know that places are named for the inn signs, and a very grotesque inn sign, the bull with a big mouth, not the bull's mouth, but another one, was the inn sign or the tavern sign, and that's the way you sent a letter, or that's how you identified a building. And they had hired a hall, probably seated 1,000, which was at the Bull and Mouth. And now they had hired another hall nearly as big at the ABBA, he called it, ABBA. That was the Westminster Abbey. And that's another building they had. That's what Barrow is saying. We have a great place as big as the Bull and Mouth near the ABBA, where on the first days we have meetings. Truth spreads and grows. First day, by the way, Sunday, isn't it? Truth spreads and grows. The Earl of Pembroke has been with us. There is a principle of God stirring in him. And this night at Woodcock's, another place in London where they had a meeting, at the meeting was the Earl of Newport. He is truly loving to us. All things as the outward in the city are very quiet. And our sufferings are laid before this new protector. This year was the year in which Oliver had died and his son Richard had taken his place. Our sufferings are reported, that is, laid before, are reported to the new protector, who carries himself fair. Divers have been with him. That means various friends have had interviews with the new protector. Something in his council, who are now the chief actors in all things, is in agitation as to release all our friends. There's a move, apparently, in the Council of State to release all our friends who were in prison. A list of above 100 is given in. William Caton has been here a week and has gone into Kent. William Caton was the boy who been companion in Swarthmore Hall. He's gone into Kent. This is London that's written for, and he's moved down this way. I don't know. Ultimately, he spent most of his time over in Holland. But he got as far as Kent in 58 this time. In fact, he'd already been in Holland. Thomas Robertson was here last week and has gone into Hampshire. Richard Hubberthorne is about Newcastle. Well, Hampshire's down here, and Newcastle is up in here, Newcastle on Tyne. So you see, in London, this man knows where various of the friends are. Now Richard Hubberthorne himself writes the same month from London. Dear sister, with my dear brethren and sisters, in the tender love of God, I salute you all, who in the measure of the Spirit of Jesus are united as living members of the body unto Christ the head. Dearly beloved, Margaret Fell, he's writing to, dearly beloved, the work of the Lord goeth on in power and in the authority of Almighty, which reigns over the heads of the wicked. The Lord is gathering in many in this city daily. There are many meetings, full and large, where there is anyone to declare the truth amongst them. Short of evangelists, if anything, manpower to carry it. And they that are great in the earth, the power of truth strives through them and is drawing them in daily. The priests confess that there is such a power amongst us that none who come to us can escape, and they exhort people not to come to us. Last first day I was at the Bull and Mouth, where there was a great and serviceable meeting. And the later part of the day I was at Westminster, these are the two centers we already mentioned, where there was a large meeting and many soldiers who are pretty faithful in their measures. J.M., that's James Naylor, was at two meetings. In the afternoon he had a great meeting where many were convinced that it had not come before, as there is in every meeting, a coming in daily. This day, if the Lord will, I'm to pass out of the city towards Dunstable to have a meeting towards the south, to have a meeting where a Baptist teacher has promised to be, and many people intending to be at. This will be quite a debate or set to. And nothing on the calendar would be so attractive as a debate between a Quaker and a Baptist. Modern entertainment couldn't compete with it in the eyes of people of that day. The next day I propose to be a Justice Crook, that's further at the north, and expect to meet my brother G.F. this week. G.F. is George Fox. Well, that's those are just early letters. I read